The following program is being brought to you on the Voice America Business Channel. For more information about our network and to check our additional show hosts and topics of interest, please visit voiceamericabusiness.com. The Voice America Talk Radio Network is the worldwide leader in live internet talk radio. Visit voiceamerica.com. The views and ideas expressed on the following program are strictly those of the host or guests and do not necessarily reflect the views and ideas held by the Voice America Talk Radio Network, its staff, and management.
Welcome to Real Recognition Radio, a program designed to promote a positive work environment. Your hosts are Roy Saunderson and S. Max Brown. In this hour, you will be motivated to motivate, increase morale, productivity, loyalty, and reduce turnover. Learn how some companies get it while others don't. Now, here are your hosts, Roy and Max.
It's all about building relationships, inspiring greatness, and creating a workplace where people can thrive. I'm Max Brown, of course, with my colleague Roy Saunderson, again from the Recognition Management Institute, coming back again week after week, Roy, week after week.
I know. It's wonderful.
It is. It is. We're having a lot of fun talking with some fantastic guests, researchers, experts in the field on how to create a better workplace. And I think a great opportunity again today to have one of those conversations.
Absolutely. Looking forward to it.
Yeah, absolutely. For me, this is an interesting one because when it comes to influencing others, and I think about leadership and really how do we influence others, perhaps even more importantly, how do we continue to get results? Influence has a huge impact on that. Our guest today, Dr. Michael Pantalon, is a research scientist at Yale University School of Medicine. He's a clinical psychologist and an award-winning faculty member at Yale University School of Medicine, I should add. And he maintains a practice as a motivational expert, working as an executive coach, consultant, speaker, and therapist, and, of course, the author of a book on how to motivate anyone quick, and it's titled Instant Influence, How to Get Anyone to Do Anything Fast. Interestingly, we also were at a conference at Harvard together. We didn't know it at the time, but there was some overlap, and I bought his book there out of interest for the topic, and then we later connected to make this show happen. But there was a common interest there, and I'm glad that you could be on our show. I know you've worked with a lot of different companies, including GE and Bristol-Myers and Nielsen and the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, National Institute of Health. Just grateful to have you on the show.
Well, thanks so much for having me on. This is my honor.
Well, we're delighted. And let's just get right into it. Why this
Sure.
topic? What brought you or, you know, gravitated you towards the topic of influence?
Yeah, well, I mean, as with many people, I kind of stumbled into this. I mean, it takes me back about 20 years when I was a brand-new psychologist. I was very green. I was all set to work with people with mental health and addiction problems because I learned all the action-oriented techniques that I needed to teach them for them to take care of these problems. And,
yeah.
You know, I never thought that I'd spend 90% of my time influencing them, convincing them to even listen and try it. And so these are some really difficult problems, and I was working – I worked – one of the toughest neighborhoods in New York City, Fort Apache, the Bronx, the South Bronx. So these were people who were not only dealing with addiction and mental health problems, but they were disenfranchised. They had very little in the way of jobs. They were dealing with medical problems. So really tough people. And I came there, green as can be, thinking that I would simply tell them, well, here's the way, and you'll get better. But one day I showed up to work, and I saw a large number of our staff standing outside of the hospital where I worked. And I went over to my unit chief, and I said, what's going on? And he said, look up there, pointing up at the sky. And I didn't look. I said, what's going on? He said, look up there. That's your patient on the ledge of that building threatening to jump. Now, this was unreal. I mean, it's a shrink's worst nightmare, but I don't mean to make light of it. At the time, my heart was pounding in my chest. 2 months on the job, 2 months into my career, And I'm thinking, what is this? What's going on? And I said, what do you want me to do? Who should I talk to? And as calm as he could, he said, don't worry about it. He's not going to jump. Just go into the emergency room and start triaging our patients. I'll be there in a little bit. And, you know, I didn't want to leave, but I was in shock. I did what he told me. But on that day, I didn't hear any of the screams or groans of pain in the ER that I usually hear. All I could hear was patients and doctors arguing. And that's when I had my aha moment. I said, if we're ever going to influence these folks to make the behavioral changes they needed to make in their lives to not end up like that poor guy, we were going to have to radically change the conversation. I mean, so I didn't know how, but I knew that because our team was speaking to that poor guy who's on the ledge of the building right now in the same way as these doctors were arguing with the patients, even though I didn't know how, I said, we have to figure out something. So we did, but that's where it came from. And that's how I came to value that motivation and influence are 90% of the job. The other stuff, the so-called hard skills, are hard, and they do their job, but they're easier to learn. There's a clearer roadmap. I spent much more time and ended up loving the arena of influence and motivation. I don't want to leave you hanging, though. The guy did not jump.
That was another part of the question.
Yeah, that's right.
I didn't know how he was going to ask.
But he got this started. Now, I could tell you more about him, but that's where it started for me.
Well, what an emotional place to start, too.
Yeah.
And like you said, sometimes these things just come to us, but it's not the way we planned. You know, the hard part for me, and as I'm reflecting on your story, which is very powerful, you know, you're not alone. We've heard and been in places where you hear a lot of people arguing and a lot of angry talk going on as opposed to something that builds people up, something that you want to follow, something that you want to hear, something that you want to go and be a part of.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a lot of people working in angry workplaces.
That's right. And then who end up feeling justified talking in that way because truth is on their side. And to be fair, you know, no judge or jury would have said that the doctors were wrong and guilty in that case. They were correct, textbook correct, but no one was listening. So that logical, rational approach to influence that says, I have truth on my side and I'll tell you about it or I'll fight you with it, but I'm justified because truth is on my side. Influence and motivation, if I've learned nothing else, is that it's not logical or rational. It's more emotional, and it doesn't follow a clear path always.
This is a big point. I mean, I've got to learn this so I can speak better to my 3-year-old.
We all I know it, but I keep practicing it too, right? So don't feel bad.
I mean, I feel like I have truth on my side when I say, please don't stand on the table because you'll fall.
Yeah.
But
he
doesn't get that part, you know?
Yeah.
So what are some of the biggest mistakes we make? Because what you just said to me is killer.
Yeah.
And I think we need to emphasize it, that even if we have the truth on our side, if people aren't listening, it doesn't matter.
It doesn't matter. No.
We have to be more effective in the way we communicate these things.
That's right. I mean, and so what matters then is to tell yourself that if that hasn't worked, as much as you would like it to work, as much sense as it makes, it doesn't work. So what do you do instead, Max? Right, that's the question. What to do instead?
Yeah,
I become committed to guiding people to come up with their own reasons for change. Now, a 3-year-old may not know that it's dangerous to stand on the table. So you have to take into account where someone is, and provide them with certain information. But all things being equal, in terms, you know, people having the right information, you want to ask questions about what their reasons might be, why they might do what they need to do. Like any one of these patients, we could have asked them, had we known, what do you think would be a benefit to you to following up with your treatment once you're discharged from the hospital? In other words, why might you decide to do that? Or what could you get out of it? Rather than only telling them and telling them repeatedly as if they were 3-year-olds. The 3-year-old you need to tell. They've been told over and over again, but they haven't yet been asked to help come up with their own reasons. And that's what really creates influence.
So now this is one of the things that intrigues me as well, and there's so much to cover in this topic that I know we won't get to all of it, but one of the pieces that fascinated me was at the conference you and I were both at the same time, they were even talking about doctors that day saying that they're not practicing what they preach either. So it's not just a patient-type scenario. We all are guilty of knowing what we should do and not doing it. Right?
That's right. Right.
There's this lack of motivation even in ourselves. And you talk about the sell and tell as not an effective way of motivating others. Can you elaborate on what that is? Because obviously, you know, the refrain about, hey, if buying a diet book would make us all skinny and healthy, then we'd all be skinny and rich and happy, you know, just by buying the books. But that's not
right.
enough.
Well, just by reading it, right? Because then the book would have told you and sold you on its good ideas. Now,
right.
I'm not bashing good ideas. I mean, we have all these self-help books because people need ideas about how to do what they want to do, lose weight, exercise more, what have you. But the information in and of itself doesn't motivate. Information is a necessary but not sufficient component of this, and in some ways it's just the beginning. So if I give you the right information to do a job, to do it well, or to lose weight, that's the bare minimum. If you don't do it, it doesn't mean I have to keep reiterating the information and in such a way as to say, well, what's wrong with you? Don't you see? It's clear.
Right.
No, that's when you get hooked into the cycle of what I call the tell and sell. I'm telling you what to do, and I'm selling you on my reasons. But the worst part about it is that I'm going to do that repeatedly.
Yeah.
I'm going to bore you to death and get you so angry, whereas the job is not information, it's motivation. And it's very hard for people to get off that treadmill of tell and sell, but it doesn't work beyond giving somebody the most rudimentary information. So instead, I try to get people to sell themselves on their own reasons for change. That's really the key. And instead of telling, we're asking. You know, so instead of telling someone to motivate them, ask them these questions.
And I love that. And you say that there's actually a psychological reason for why we don't work well with the sell and tell. Isn't that correct? It's in psychological reactance. Is that?
That's right.
Am I getting that correct?
You're getting that right. Psychological reactance, or what's more commonly known in films and movies, is reverse psychology. Is that we have an inner teenager, either because we remember our teenage years, or it's just pre-programmed. We don't know why it's there, but four decades of credible social and psychological science tell us two very clear things, that the more you tell somebody that they absolutely have to do something, the less they're going likely they are to do it, and the more you tell somebody that they really should not do something, the more likely they are to do it. The flip side of the same coin. And as much
fascinating.
As, yeah, I mean, CEOs and leaders of businesses or organizations, doctors, don't want to believe that they fall prey to that.
Yeah.
And it almost sounds silly because it is in sitcoms and stuff, but it is so true. And if you look at healthcare, look at certain businesses, it's run by the tell and sell. But because of psychological reactance, we get people doing often the opposite of what we want them to do.
Yeah. Actually go in the very wrong direction. But for my son, man, he just grits his teeth and he looks at me and goes, Dad, I know. You've already told me that.
Oh. Well, that's Max, that's a smart three-year-old.
He is.
Right?
He really is.
He's
smart.
Telling you, Dad, I got the information. Now, you know, pony up with the motivation.
Yeah, I mean, he's still sitting there going, I still like standing on the table. I don't know why that's a problem because I already accept the risk that you've told me about.
there you go, but... Here, I'm not saying go home and do this with the three-year-old. We haven't quite worked it out there. But based on my own personal experience, it does tend to work even with the most, you know, young people. You would say, for example, well, I know you like standing on the table. I got that. And standing really isn't the problem. But why do you think it's dangerous to stand on the table? You tell me.
That's
you know,
so much better.
Yeah, just like, you know, a mom wants her son to clean up the room, and she's telling him all her reasons why she wants it cleaned and that he has to, which is just going to kill it. If she says, well, tell me, what would be in it for you if you were to clean the room? Well, then I'd be able to find that new football I got for Christmas. And as silly as that sounds, and as much as both parties know that one is intentionally trying to influence the other – if the influence is gotten via that person's own reason for change, then it doesn't feel manipulative or that someone's using undue influence. It's just that we've motivated someone enough to take some action.
It's good stuff. It's great
Thank
stuff.
You.
I'm so glad you're on the show with us today. We have to take a quick break, but when we come back, we'll continue this conversation with Dr. Michael Pantalon. You're listening to Real Recognition Radio on the Voice America Business Channel. Please stay tuned. We'll be right back.
When it comes to business, you'll find the experts here. Voice America Business Network. How do you become one of the best companies to work for? By appreciating people for who they are and recognizing them for what they do. That's real recognition. 82% of employees say that recognition or praise they receive at work motivates them to improve their performance. And companies who recognize their people outperform companies that don't by 30 to 40%. Those are real results. Become one of the best companies to work for. The Recognition Management Institute can help you get the results you need. For more information, visit realrecognition.com. That's realrecognition.com.
Relationships are the core of great businesses. Your employees are critical to the success of your business. Rideau helps you build positive relationships with your people. Rideau helps you inspire greatness in your people. We do it through the power of recognition and rewards. Rideau's clients are Intel, RBC Financial, Boeing, and Liberty Mutual. We're committed to our clients and our people. Together, Rideau and our clients create better workplaces, better businesses, and ultimately, a better world. Become a Rideau client. Find us at rideau.com. Rideau is the proud sponsor of Real Recognition Radio.
When it comes to business, you'll find the experts here. Voice America Business Network.
You're listening to Real Recognition Radio with Roy Saunderson and S. Max Brown. This is what recognition is all about, getting real results in the workplace through meaningful recognition solutions. Now, let's get back to the program. Here are Roy and Max.
Welcome back to Real Recognition Radio. I'm Roy Saunderson along with Max Brown, and our guest today, Dr. Michael Pantalon, a research scientist at Yale University School of Medicine. And, oh, my goodness, was I writing notes down about all the right ways to say things. I mean, like, all of a sudden I've been reliving my parenthood of five kids and going, didn't do that right, But, you know, it's like we get caught up with this telling, don't we?
Yeah, we do.
And what do you think the reasons are that we don't get into finding out the reasons of other people?
Well, I think it's twofold. One is telling is so easy. You know, and, you know, especially with our kids, you know, perhaps our friends and our spouses and our colleagues are tired of our stories, but the kids, they're you know, helpless victims. So we tell and tell and tell. You know, and let truth be told, I still do it. You know, God help me if one of my sons is listening to the show when it airs. Dad, you could do a little bit more of this too. But I know when I make myself do it, and go this very different way, it works. But that comprises the second issue here. It is a very different way. It's not a logical, rational way to talk. And when I train people, they look at me, you want me to say, why might you decide to do this, even though they just said they don't want to?
Uh-huh.
Isn't that going to be odd-sounding? And I say, yes, that's good. That's going to grab their attention.
Right
but
away.
To your point, Roy, it's hard. We keep telling because we would never have just simply thought this up, you know, on the spot. It's very
no. And it's like everything else with child rearing, at least. You know, there's no you read all the books on parenting, and it, the only problem is the kids haven't read the books.
Right. But you know, I've had a number of CEOs tell me that it's useful to think through parenting skills when they're thinking about some difficult employees.
Absolutely.
And not to belittle people, but isn't it all about doing a little bit of a better job at parenting?
That.
At work, too.
There's universal principles. And I know you talk about some steps for creating what you're calling this instant influence. Could you could you elaborate on those for us?
Sure. Okay, so that there's six steps to instant influence, and those are really just questions. And the whole point of having all six steps be questions is to really sort of move people away from the telling and selling. You could say to them, look, I know you want to tell them, and you want to tell them what to do and your reasons. You can say that, get it out of the way so that they know where you're coming from, but that is simply not going to motivate them or influence them. So get that out of your system, and then you're going to ask these six questions. But there's a quick little thing you need to do to grease the skids before the questions, and that's reinforcing autonomy. So if psychological reactance tells us that if you tell people they have to do something and that they're not going to do it then, or
right.
there's less of a chance, then the first step is to acknowledge their autonomy and to simply say, look, whether or not you follow this new procedure we've put into your sales department, for example, is up to you. You know I'd like you to do it. I've explained how and why I think it would be good for your department and for your people. But ultimately, that's up to you. And that takes away the drive of psychological reactance to undermine what the authority says.
Mm-hmm.
So that part has to be there. It's up to you whether or not you stand on the table. You know, if it's a three-year-old, you can take them down with your physical will, but their physical will may override that, and they just get right back up. So even with a three-year-old, you say, look, it's up to you whether or not you stand there, or to your kid who's not wearing his retainer. It's up to you whether or not you wear that. I'm not going to be there 24/7. So the same thing with the CEO. But would you mind if I asked you a few questions? And that reinforces their autonomy, too, because they could say no. They almost always say yes.
Right.
And then we get into the six questions. So I'll pause there if you have questions about how to grease the skids. But then
I love the term.
Yeah.
That's good. Good, good, good. I love the whole autonomy piece because it's like – it turns the tables, and it must kind of throw people at first.
It does. Mm-hmm. I think that's part of the power is that, you know, truth be told, when you're talking to somebody doesn't necessarily mean they're listening, but when you say something unexpected and surprise them, you grab their attention, and they go, oh, what, you said it's up to me? Wait a minute, how could that be? I thought you said I had to do it. And if nothing else, you got immediate engagement.
Right.
And when you surprise people, another benefit of this is that you lower their defenses. Because, you know, if you're changing your script, if you're not saying have to's anymore, then they're going to start to wonder, well, how else is this conversation going to be different than it has before? You get their attention.
Gotcha. Mm-hmm. Well,
and
Mike, I don't mind if you ask me a few questions.
Okay. So then let's go back to this. I'm thinking of a middle-level manager in a large corporation. He's in the sales department, and there's a new procedure that's been instituted. It seems simple, but it's going to require people. It's a few more steps in their CRM, and it's going to require people to meet with this middle manager more frequently, or rather, the middle manager is going to have to meet with them more frequently. And this manager's he's not a FaceTime kind of guy.
Mm-hmm.
And yet he's a high potential. They want to keep him around. And so I'm working with him to get to meeting with his people more frequently but productively. Because when he was told he has to listen, everybody else has listened, you haven't, you're the lone holdout, he still didn't do it. Or he did, but the meetings weren't so productive.
All right.
So to him, we've reinforced the autonomy. Look, you don't have to do this, but would you mind if I ask you some questions? He says yes. I start with, well, look, if you ever were to have more meetings and to work at making them as productive as your superiors would like them to be, why would you decide to do that? And that's question number one, or step number one. Why might you change? You say, why might you, and then you fill in the blank with the thing that you want the person to do. And again, they look at you like you have three heads, but then I follow up and I said, no, look, I know their reasons. But I want to know if there's anything in it for you. Appeal to their selfish side, if you will. Even.
Sure.
That's step one. This guy, unfortunately, said, well, because they told me I have to, and I don't want to get into trouble. How motivating does that sound to you guys? Not so good. It's a reason. He came up with it. But it's not that sort of intrinsic or internal drive that I'm looking for in these questions.
Yeah.
And I'm not going to throw it away or discount it. I'll say, yeah, you're right. So one thing is that it's important to you how they react to your performance. But if you were to have these meetings, what would make you want to have them? And he said, I don't know. So what do you do in the six-step process? You go to the next step. The next two steps are connected. So step two is me asking this manager, on a scale of 1 to 10, where 1 means you're not ready at all and 10 means you're totally ready, how ready are you to have more consistent meetings with your team? And he sits back and he thinks and he says, look, with this look of I'm going to be straight with you, it's only a 3. Now, what do you think most people would, if they're thinking with the logical, rational parts of their brains, would want to say when this guy says 3? Everybody wants to say, well, why aren't you at least a little bit more motivated? Why aren't you at least a 5? You're the lone holdout. You're creating trouble. What would the manager then say? He would say, well, I already manage a good team. I can do it remotely. They don't want to have meetings. That'll just drain their time. He'll just come up with excuses.
Right.
So question 3 or step 3 of my process is to take that number that you got in what I call the readiness ruler, and instead of asking him why he isn't more motivated, we say, why didn't you pick a lower number? In essence, why aren't you less motivated?
Ooh.
And again, he looked at me like I had 3 heads, and he said, you want me to be less ready? I said, no, I want to know why you have any readiness at all. And he said, because this job is the only job I've ever loved, and I want to keep it. And we got emotion. We got something real. But I'll pause there, see if you have any questions. Those are the first 3 steps. Why might you change? How ready are you to change? And why aren't you less ready? Why didn't you pick a lower number?
Well, my only question would be, what if you were a 1?
Right. Okay, so that happens sometimes, but it's incredibly surprising to me how rare that is. But if somebody says a 1, you say, no, I don't want people to worry about it, but you do need to know what to say. You ask, what would it take for that 1 to turn into a 2? And so if this guy had said 1, absolutely no way, then I know I'm dealing with a tougher situation. But then I say, what would it take for that 1 to turn into a 2? And if he had said, well, if I had a little bit more time to start these meetings, like 2 weeks, because they have this other project they want us to do, then we know that we need to change our strategy a little bit. He's given us a tip in terms of how to motivate him. But then my questions would turn into sort of just 2 weeks out. So, you know, on a scale of 1 to 10, how ready would you be to do this if they gave you those 2 weeks? Well, then it's a 3 or 4. It tells us how to rephrase the question so that they're more likely to give us a higher number.
Okay.
But then we still say, why didn't you pick a lower number?
Mm-hmm. All right, I'm ready.
So you're identifying their hope.
Sorry, Max?
So you're identifying their hope, whatever degree that is.
Right, hope or passion, dedication, whatever it is, you put your finger on it because it becomes more emotional. When motives become more personal, they get closer and closer to being more emotional. And when he said, this is the only job I've ever loved, and I want to keep it, now we're getting some intrinsic motivation. He loves his job, but it's still a little extrinsic because he's worried that he'll be let go or something will be done to him. So I'm still working through my questions to get more intrinsic motivation. So I go to question 4 or step 4, and I say, imagine you've done what your bosses have asked you to do. You've had these meetings more consistently, and they've been productive. What would be good about that for you? What would be some of the good outcomes for you? So in this question, I have the person imagine doing what up until now they haven't wanted to. And even if they say, I haven't promised that, as this guy did, I say, I'm not saying that you've promised. I'm just saying pretend. Imagine.
Yep.
And then it started to crack. When I asked him that, he said that the department on the whole might be running more smoothly. He recognized that even though he didn't think the changes to the process were needed, that he was slowing down the department's overall movement in this new direction. That's question 4. Question 5 is you take that reason that he gave you in question 4, which is that the department would be running more smoothly, and you ask why he cares about that, why that's important to him And I usually do that five times. It goes still goes very quick. These conversations take about 7 minutes on average. But in a rapid succession, I ask him, why is it important for you for the department to run more smoothly? And he says, well, you know, because I'd be happier if the department ran smoothly. And then I say, why is it important for you to be happier at work? And then he says, because things have been pretty tense and it would be a welcome change. And again, I just persist and I say, well, why would having less tension at work be important to you? You notice I'm just saying the same.
Right.
Why is that important to you? And it goes rather quick because I know what my next question is. And he says, that would make me feel good. And I said, and if you were to feel good at work, why would that be good? Why would that be important to you? And finally he broke because he said, you know, all my life I've wanted to be a leader. And I mean a real leader, somebody who sets the tone and gets things going and adapts when adaptations are needed. And he says, I always thought I had it in me, but I have to say it looks like I haven't been doing that. I mean, I've wanted to because my father's had always been so passive at work, and I said that would never be me, and I'll do better than him. And this guy broke down, and he goes, I have done a lot better. I've made better choices, made more money, got better positions, but I'm still doing the same thing he did, and I'm sort of shying away from my team. If I got in there, who knows? We'd all be happier, and who knows? Sky's the limit with our department.
Mm-hmm.
That's what we're looking for. Does it always end up being a watershed moment like that? No, but it doesn't need to be. But with these simple, easy-to-remember questions, you get really hard-nosed CEOs or whoever to really start thinking about what would be in it for them.
Mm-hmm. Wow. I just felt like my whole my mind has been going through a process of even going through this. And how do you keep these questions on track? I mean, is it okay to have these as written tools initially once you start up with this? Because this process is pretty powerful.
Absolutely. You can have them in front of you. You can even tell people, look, we've had tough conversations about this thing I've needed you to do at work. And frankly, I so don't want to have that conversation again that I wrote out a few notes about a different conversation I'd like to have. And that may make the other person anxious, so you can even show it to them. The only risk is that you feel a little hokey. But you can even say that, and then the power differential that gets minimized to some degree works to the leader's advantage, which, right, wouldn't we all agree that reducing that a little bit?
Naming it.
Yeah. You can have that script in front of you, but frankly, I train thousands of people, and they come back, and they often gravitate to one or two of the questions that they can memorize.
Yeah.
And since they're all getting at the same information a slightly different way, maybe only one or two is needed in a particular conversation.
Mm-hmm. Well, I tell you, Mike, this has been a very powerful insight for getting into intrinsic motivation. And I know Max will want to continue in the next segment further in this. We're going to take a quick break here. But for our listeners, join us back in a few minutes on Real Recognition Radio as we continue this great discussion with Dr. Michael Pantalon and learn more about instant influence. For Real Recognition Radio, this is Roy Sonneson and Max Brown.
From the boardroom to you, Voice America Business Network.
The next generation of employees is more sophisticated about recognition. They want to make a difference to their organizations, to their environment, and to their world. Rideau offers a full suite of recognition and reward solutions tailored to meet our clients' needs strategically, technologically, and globally. Rideau's clients are Intel, RBC Financial, Boeing, and Liberty Mutual. Together, Rideau and our clients create better workplaces, better businesses, and ultimately, a better world. Become a Rideau client. Find us at rideau.com. Rideau is the proud sponsor of Real Recognition Radio.
How do you become one of the best companies to work for? By appreciating people for who they are and recognizing them for what they do. That's real recognition. 82% of employees say that recognition or praise they receive at work motivates them to improve their performance. And companies who recognize their people outperform companies that don't by 30 to 40%. Those are real results. Become one of the best companies to work for. The Recognition Management Institute can help you get the results you need. For more information, visit realrecognition.com. That's realrecognition.com.
Voice America Business Network, the bottom line in business.
You're listening to Real Recognition Radio with Roy Saunderson and S. Max Brown. This is what recognition is all about, getting real results in the workplace through meaningful recognition solutions. Now, let's get back to the program. Here are Roy and Max.
Welcome back to Real Recognition Radio with Roy Saunderson and, of course, myself, Max Brown, and our guest, Dr. Michael Pantalon, who's blowing our minds off today. Giving us lots of great research, and he's a research scientist at Yale University School of Medicine, talking about the power of influence. You had just been talking with Roy about these positive why questions and a scenario with someone you're working with to get them down a path where they're not resisting the suggestions but letting themselves see for them what the benefit is in following why this might be useful and beneficial to themselves. What are the final questions we have to ask?
So after this manager said all of this about his father, I make a point to sort of summarize for him, because he's been through the process. I've blown his mind, and so I want to make sure that I consolidate what we've gotten. And so I feed back to him. I said, so look, if you simply add in a few extra meetings, I sort of downplay how difficult the requested behavior is. You will get so much more, because in comparison to his incentives now, his intrinsic incentives, the behavior that's being asked of him seems relatively small. Mm-hmm. So I said, if you were to have these extra meetings and work at them the way your boss has asked, you're going to do what you ultimately wanted to do in your career, which is to have a very different leadership style than your dad, to be a leader, and to be one of those who's around and sets the tone and gets as much out of his people as possible. And boy, did his chest pump up. And he said, that sounds great the way you said it. And I said, well, no, that's what you said to me. And he really felt proud. Now, the last question, the only last thing we need to do, it may seem a fait accompli, but it's not. You say, what's the next step, if any? And the reason I say, if any, is to hearken back to the autonomy, because it's still up to him whether or not he does anything. So I say, what's the next step, if any? And he goes, what are you kidding? You know, I love these people. They've worked hard for me. We're going to have the meetings. And it's as if it had been his idea all along. It's as if there was never any resistance. So you got to make sure that you don't at the end say, well, then if it was that easy, why didn't you do it before? Because then you will have messed it all up. But that's the last question. What's the next step?
So the final conclusion is not to say, you idiot. That's what we've been trying to get you to think about.
That's right. Or, you know, don't make it sound like it was your idea. We've been telling you. And that is a risk. That's a risk. You will be tempted.
You know, that's absolutely true. You're absolutely right. The idea that you want to make sure that you get credit for the idea, or that someone succeeded because of, as opposed to just allowing them to take ownership.
Oh, absolutely. And that's why doctors sometimes, you know, myself included, have a hard time with this, because they got into this field to help people. If it ends up seeming to the patient that the patient came up with all the ideas and their own motivation to do it, then the doctor's left out of that sort of attribution for improvement, and that doesn't feel great. But
right.
It's important.
There's got to be a little bit of ego stroke, that value fill.
Yeah.
But here's the next the segue to that, and you write about this in the book, which I really appreciate. But you talk about then why this empathy is so important as part of this, and I think it relates to what you're talking about now, that you're giving the ownership not only to them, but allowing them to revel in the position that they came up with this themselves as well.
Right.
That empathy is allowing them and yourself to understand that the bigger picture is done. It's no longer about you even needing to be a part of it. You were simply a messenger, and they were able to go forward.
Right. Or a facilitator, an interviewer. You're asking questions mainly, but the empathy is huge. And it's not just the sort of empathy that requires reflection of their own thoughts about why they may or may not want to do something, but empathy around the fact that this is their struggle. It could be your business. It could be your management approach that you're in implementing that you want them to do, but ultimately they're in charge of their own behavior. And so we're empathizing around their own decision making. And I wouldn't have it any other way, because when people come up with their own motivation in this process, it's sustainable. It's like green motivation. It will continue on rather than you always needing to tell them what they need to do.
Now, what happens then with this, and I think there's a big distinction here with the empathy versus a manipulation, because you learn this as a skill
mm-hmm.
as opposed to a fundamental belief that we can make people better, you know? And I think there's a big distinction that way, that we're not just learning something by a step-by-step process to manipulate,
right.
but that we actually do it because we believe that there's something inherently good about the process.
Well, where does the belief reside, though? It resides internally. So
yeah.
there is a chance that somebody can portray on the outside this empathy, because it is a technique, and these questions, and on the inside really be wanting to manipulate. There's no way to completely guard against that. I mean, everything
yes.
I write in the book is influencing for good, but, you know, even the word influence may give somebody that perception, and that's an unfortunate side effect of that. But everything that we're writing in here is about influencing for good. But what can you do if somebody's trying to manipulate with these questions? They might try, but people really only change for their own good reasons. And if somebody starts out with a manipulative tone, it will only work if they help the other person come up with what they really want and for their own
yeah.
reasons. So I think it's tough for it to end up working as manipulation, but somebody can try to be manipulative.
You know, it's a good point. And the only reason I bring it up is because, like most of us that do work with companies, if you see, like, the latest book that they've read and they shared it with the group, it's not that there isn't a great effort forward to help improve and make things better, but the problem becomes when they just memorize it as a gimmick as opposed to something that can actually be applied with the right motive in mind.
Yeah, well, you know, you've touched on something that's sort of a hot button for me. It's a tension, I think, in the work that the three of us do. I coach and consult and work with companies all around the world, and they're always saying we need these soft skills. We need to learn more about it, but then sometimes they're denigrated because they're quote-unquote soft skills, you know, so
yes.
we come up with a script. We try to make them look like hard skills. You follow this protocol and you'll get what you want, which is what I attempted to do in the book as well, and I think it's worked out well. But there is this tension between, if it's a soft skill, it cannot be too scripted. But
well, that's a good point.
But if people look at soft skills and they say, well, it always sounds so theoretical and you never tell me exactly what to do or say, they're never
right.
going to do it. So this
right.
has been my sort of balancing act here. But you're right. It's a tough question.
That's a good point. If we could, for a moment, I want to go back to that scenario you suggested.
Mm-hmm.
And you're leading this gentleman through a conversation. And in the book, you specifically talk about change talk and that we should listen for it. And you defined it as any statement uttered by the person that you're talking to that suggests he is starting to think about change or perhaps even moving towards it. And,
right.
and so in that, you said that there are six types of change talk
mm-hmm.
that you should use to help respond to. So kind of coming back to, you know, well, it is a soft skill, but we do have some specific ways to do it.
Right.
Kind of give you some direction here. What are some of the ways we can manage this conversation and be more effective at it?
Right. Okay. So then let me put it in context. So we start by working with somebody who says no to something, right? Like
right.
this middle manager.
Mm-hmm.
And we start by saying, look, you don't absolutely have to do it. We'd like you to, but
yep.
do you mind if I ask you some questions?
Yep.
Then we ask him the six questions we went through, all along hoping that those questions evoke from him his own intrinsic, personal, and maybe even emotional reasons why he might choose to do what, prior to this conversation, he's been saying no to. That's our
mm-hmm.
context. Every time one of the questions gets at one of those reasons or change talk in general, then we want to be able to identify it to ourselves and then to reflect it back, to simply reiterate it or state it back to the person. So it does become sort of protocolized, because you have to remember the questions and then listen for some good answers and then reiterate them. I have a scheme of six types of change talk
statements to look for. The first is ability talk. Yeah, I can have those meetings. I could fit it in. If he had said that, then I'd want to say, well, okay, you can envision yourself doing this. That's an example of it's ability talk, which is one of the types of change talk, and that's an example of me reflecting it. But there are other types of statements, like this guy, need talk is another type of change talk. He said, yeah, I need to do this because I love this job and I want to keep it. That's why I reflected it when he said that. Later on, he said he had want talk or desire talk. He said, you know, I want to rise above where my dad's stage was, and I want to be a better leader. That's really where the action is, especially if there's emotion behind it. Action talk is when the person says, I'm going to do it. So at the very end, when I said, what's the next step, he said, well, what are you kidding? I can do this, and I think we'll have a lot of fun. You want to reflect, you're planning on doing this. That's great.
Yeah. And I love that. But so it is a specific nuance in the language as you go along as well. It's not simply leading them through those six questions, but actually listening, like you said, to those proactive responses in such a way that you kind of key into what kind of things they're expressing.
Right. So are they expressing ability, need, want, action? I often listen most for reasons. Like I want to hear because.
Okay.
And then my ears perk up because I might do this because that's where the action is. And ultimately, the commitment that you should get at the end of this process, which almost always you do, you get some commitment. You want to be able to feed that back to them and say, well, it sounds like, you know, you're going to do this. You're committed to making that happen. Mm-hmm. It's important because people might hear themselves giving you good reasons for change, but because they're in the process, they need you to feed it back to them just a little bit so that they hear their own words coming back and that influences them further.
Well, and that goes to some research that suggests, you know, that even a diabetic will continue to come in back and forth and back and forth and
right.
even to the end refusing their insulin for whatever reasons.
Mm-hmm.
But until you finally get to that action plan, which you've suggested, so they've heard their self-talk and they know that they need that better health change in their life, but that action plan has got to be key, isn't it? So once you've got
right.
this path forward and you've had this conversation, you have to create an action plan.
That's right. Yeah. And so, but listen to this tension. I agree with that. All the science is behind it. But I still can't say to this middle manager, now, before you leave this room, we have to have an action plan, you know?
Okay.
Because then,
okay.
because of psychological reactance, he's going to like, well, but you're just a coach or a consultant. I am not answering to you. I'm going to go do my own thing. So the have to is true, but it stays in my head. And now I sort of lead him on a conversation to simply ask, you know, how do you plan on following through on this? What are some rough ideas? But the tension comes if you don't want to necessarily force someone to write it down, even though we know that writing is helpful. But I put it out there as suggestions. You might want to make it clear as to when and where you're going to do it. How are you going to let people know? If you write it down, it's often more likely to happen. But that's up to you. I can't make you do that. So the autonomy is important, too, when you're making the action plan.
So it's obviously recognizing the autonomy the whole way through.
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah. And it's dignity, isn't it? I mean, I just love the fact that we're offering dignity and respect in a way here that increases influence without belittling someone.
Absolutely. It's their deal. It's their struggle, you know, and it's their consequences to deal with if that's what they choose. I mean, I've had a lot of CEOs say, well, Mike, you know, they like your work with them and things seem to be moving, but at some point, you're going to say to them, they have to do this or there are going to be consequences, right?
Yeah.
And I always say, well, no, I'm not going to do that. And let me explain why. I can communicate via, you know, you can communicate via me what those consequences are. But I always say to them, you know, you might be moved by that and you might not be. That's your choice.
Yeah.
You know, your boss says, you know, those consequences will happen, but it's still up to you whether or not that matters to you.
Yeah.
And that's when people really perk up and say, oh, this is a different way of getting motivated. This is a different way of influence. And people really like it.
I really appreciate the conversation. We have to take a quick break.
Sure.
When we come back, we'll do the final segment. And My goodness, we need like three or four more segments, I'm afraid. But for Real Recognition Radio, this is Max Brandon Roy Saunderson. You're listening to Dr. Michael Pantalon talking today about instant influence and how it really can change and make things better. We'll be right back.
When it comes to business, you'll find the experts here. Voice America Business Network.
Relationships are the core of great businesses. Your employees are critical to the success of your business. Rideau helps you build positive relationships with your people. Rideau helps you inspire greatness in your people. We do it through the power of recognition and rewards. Rideau's clients are Intel, RBC Financial, Boeing, and Liberty Mutual. We're committed to our clients and our people. Together, Rideau and our clients create better workplaces, better businesses, and ultimately, a better world. Become a Rideau client. Find us at rideau.com. Rideau is the proud sponsor of Real Recognition Radio.
How do you become one of the best companies to work for? By appreciating people for who they are and recognizing them for what they do. That's real recognition. 82% of employees say that recognition or praise they receive at work motivates them to improve their performance. And companies who recognize their people outperform companies that don't by 30 to 40%. Those are real results. Become one of the best companies to work for. The Recognition Management Institute can help you get the results you need. For more information, visit realrecognition.com. That's realrecognition.com.
The business community's first choice in Internet Talk Radio. Voice America Business Network.
You're listening to Real Recognition Radio with Roy Saunderson and S. Max Brown. This is what recognition is all about: getting real results in the workplace through meaningful recognition solutions. Now, let's get back to the program. Here are Roy and Max.
Welcome back to Real Recognition Radio. We're going to finish off our conversation today with Dr. Michael Pantalon and learn some final pointers on instant influence. And this has been just a great discussion today, Mike, and I think where I'm just kind of, I'm caught up with the power of it, but I'm realizing, my goodness, as the person asking these questions, you really do have to have the right motivation yourself in using this strategy.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, you, on one hand, want the job done. You want the person you're talking to do what they need to do. So that's why you're having a focused conversation. But on the other hand, and even more importantly, you have to be thinking, if this is going to go well, the reasons for change, the reasons for doing what you want them to do has to come from the person that you're talking to. I mean, the bottom line, think of it this way, the bottom line is people really only listen to one person. And I'm sorry, it's not their CEO, not their mother, and it may not even be their spouse. It's themselves. And
right.
So this instant influence approach is about getting people to convince themselves to do what needs to get done. So you got to hold on to that. And at first, have faith until you see it work, but then people become true believers very easily.
And that was my concern too, Mike, is that obviously in this reflective questioning style, surely not every situation you sit down with turns out to be quote-unquote going your way.
Right.
How do you deal with the – there must be some break points sometimes, but at least it ends on a good point, you know, for the individual.
That's right. So if we're getting to a breaking point where you shouldn't go on and on for hours with this. It's designed to be a minutes long approach.
A few minutes, yeah.
It's better to end on some agreement than on no agreement. And
right.
If you, for example – try to influence one of your workers to do X, Y, or Z all the time, and you're getting to a breaking point, then you should stop and say, thanks for having the conversation. I appreciate it. Would you mind if we came back to it another time? And then you have to regroup and ask for less. You can't influence somebody to do something all the time if they haven't ever done it. Influence them to do it once the next time. You know, so if there's a breaking point, usually it's because we've been trying to influence for too far out, for too much. But then other times I've had things work out beautifully but not at all as I expected. I mean, people sometimes come up with better ideas than their bosses had even initiated, and I go back and I'm kind of anxious because the person has said no to what the boss wanted and what I was trying to motivate them to do, but they came back with something better. And, you know, you have to allow for that creative freedom. Sometimes this motivates people, but not exactly for the thing you thought needed to happen.
Maybe
sometimes it works out.
That's maybe the key point there.
Right.
Now, you know, Mike, for everyone who's been listening to this show, I know they're going to want to learn more about this wonderful concept of instant influence. Can you tell us a little bit how you can get hold of the book and also maybe a URL or way people can reach out to you?
Absolutely. So my book is called Instant Influence, How to Get Anyone to Do Anything Fast. It's not an academic read. It's a simple, easy-to-follow approach that gets you to influence people that work for you and or even your kids, whoever, and they can learn more about the book as well as my coaching and consulting services at www.michaelpantalon.com. And the book is available everywhere books are sold.
Wonderful, wonderful. Well, we certainly do want to encourage our listeners to go deeper into this more intrinsic side of motivation that is a very powerful technique and one that I know I need to kind of get my head around and practice more frequently to get the good results that you've discussed on our show today.
Yes.
Go ahead, Mike.
No, it's been my pleasure. This has been a fascinating conversation. Thank you.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Now, if we want to leave our listeners with something, I'm just curious, what would be one step that you would probably recommend to people that would be the most beneficial in influencing others so they can put their best foot forward going on this technique?
Well, the next time you want to influence someone, and by influence, I don't mean manipulate them.
Right.
It simply means a little bit more than motivate them. When we're motivating people, that's great, but often it doesn't get to the tipping point of action. So think of influence as motivation plus some action. And next time you want to influence someone, instead of saying, tell me what's gotten in your way of doing that, or yeah, you should do that. That's great. I did it. You should do it too. Instead, ask the off-the-beaten but more motivating question, which is, well, what are your reasons for doing that? Why might you do that? What would be good about that? Look for the positive why. Look for reasons why somebody may want to do the positive behavior. And don't tell them your reasons. Ask them, why might you do that?
Well, I think that's a very powerful closing point there, Mike, and thank you so much for being on the show today and sharing these very powerful techniques with us.
My pleasure. It's been great.
Matt? Absolutely. Grateful we connected, Mike, and look forward to staying connected as well.
That would be wonderful. Anytime.
Thank you.
Well, listen, for all of our listeners, we certainly appreciate them joining us for this show, and we invite you to tune in to our next show where Max and I will continue our discussion on how to build relationships, inspire greatness, and create a workplace where people can thrive. And we certainly welcome you to send in your comments and suggestions for future guests. And we invite you to go to rideau.com/radio, that's rideau.com/radio, to give us your feedback and tell us why you listen to Real Recognition Radio. Or you can just simply email us at feedback@realrecognition.com. We look forward to hearing from you. And thanks for listening to Real Recognition Radio. For more information about the Recognition Management Institute, you can also visit us at realrecognition.com. Until next time, this is Roy Sonneson and Max Brown reminding you to keep it real.
Thank you again for tuning in Real Recognition Radio. Please join Roy Sonderson and Max Brown again next Tuesday at 10 a.m. Pacific Time, 1 p.m. Eastern Time on the Voice America Business Channel for more motivational tips to help your employees perform better. We'll talk again next week.